This is the takeaway for Wednesday, March 7th, 2018.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, and it's good to have you here by our side today. And at the White House, the president will have his sometimes beloved, sometimes ostracized economic advisor by his side no longer. Gary Cohn is leaving the White House. Announced in the same week, the president says he's charging ahead with global tariffs on steel and aluminum. Gary Cohn fought against those tariffs and ultimately lost, it appears. Gary Cohn got the praise from his boss on Twitter when he announced that he's leaving the White House. The president tweeted that Gary has done a superb job on historic tax cuts, reforms. He called Gary Cohn a rare talent and thanked him for his service to the American people. Now, Gary Cohn nearly resigned after the president's response to Charlottesville and the white supremacist marches there in August when the president said there are good people on both sides of that debate. That apparently wasn't the last straw for Gary Cohn at the time, but steel and aluminum tariffs, well, they were. I have a couple of experts here to talk about Gary Cohn's time at the White House and those tariffs that appear to have finally driven him from what he calls his dream job at the White House. Gary Rivlin is a fellow at the Investigative Fund who most recently tracked Gary Cohn's role at the White House for The Intercept. He joins me now in the studio. Gary, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also here, Alex Lawson, Law 360 senior reporter and co-host of the Law 360 Pro Se podcast. Alex, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Gary, it's been a tumultuous tenure for Gary Cohn as economic advisor. Were you surprised in the end that losing the debate in the White House over tariffs and the president's apparent intention to charge ahead with these tariffs is finally what's driving Gary Cohn to resign?
Well, not really. I mean, he's been on the edge of resigning for months now. To me, he got done largely what he came to do. I mean, slash corporate taxes by 40%, cut the personal income tax. There's been some rollback of financial regulations around initial public offerings, etc. And like, that was his agenda coming in. He's largely accomplished what he set out to do. And, you know, I can't imagine it's an easy job to work in the Trump White House.
Alex, President Trump campaigned hard on these trade issues, and it's probably the area where he's been the most consistent mm-hmm. in his presidency from what he talked about in the campaign. Did analysts think that Gary Cohn would win out in this long debate over tariffs that despite his promises, President Trump wouldn't forge ahead here?
Oh, gosh. I mean, if I had an answer for what analysts thought Trump might do or not do on trade, I mean, I would be in a much different position today. I don't know. I mean, Cohn was one of a handful of so-called, you know, right-minded thinkers on trade that were trying to convince the president to, you know, kind of soften up on tariffs. One thing to note, when these steel and aluminum probes were announced, there's like a year-long, almost year-long investigative period. And initially, they were going to come out and deliver some recommendations within like 6 weeks or something. They're like, we're going to do this very quickly. Then it got put on the back burner, and everybody kind of took that as a sign that, oh, somebody got into Trump's ear and said, you know, we don't need to crack down on steel and aluminum too hard. And the conventional wisdom became, you know, they'll soften up a little bit. Maybe they'll do something targeted at China or Vietnam or some other sort of, you know, high volume steel producer. But then, you know, Trump emerged from a listening session with steel and aluminum industry leaders and kind of just happened to blurt out 25% tariff on steel, 10% tariff on aluminum next week, book it. And everybody kind of went in a tizzy. So I guess I don't really know what analysts thought Gary Cohn yeah. might do, but it seems to have been upended.
But there were lots of signals, as you said, throughout the year that he might be slowing this down, and now it's happening. Look, the markets have reacted to this announcement in tariffs very negatively. Prices yeah. have tumbled. Alex, stock prices tumbled the last time people thought Gary Cohn was going to leave the White House. Mm-hmm. Now he is leaving. What is it that investors think is going to happen with Gary Cohn not around that they're apparently skittish now?
Well, I mean, I think that what you're going to see is, I mean, the conventional wisdom has become that you'll see an emboldening of this kind of economic nationalism. And, you know, in my area of expertise anyway is trade. And that if these tariffs take root, the idea is, you know, if we close our door to foreign competition, then we're dealing only with domestically sourced things, and that is going to raise prices on consumers. So, I mean, that's a different question, I guess, than investors. But, you know, it's not a very popular idea. I mean, the whole idea of, like, having an open market is, you know, having a competitive marketplace where different revenue streams and different product streams can compete with each other. And it's sort of like, you know, this is why Gary Cohn was always, like, derisively labeled a globalist. I saw Mick Mulvaney sort of called him that in his statement today. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, sort of the dynamics we're going to see.
Globalist in scare quotes is what
I know. It was weird. It was just like, it was such a nice to work with this globalist. Never thought I would have got along with this guy.
Yeah, it's a euphemism sometimes. yeah. Gary, well, Mick Mulvaney and others remain behind at the White House. It's a corollary question. If the markets are spooked now, what do the markets think remains behind at the White House in terms of the advice that the president will get on the economy if Gary Cohn, the Democrat, the globalist, the right thinker on the economy, Mr. Calm, isn't around?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is who's going to replace him? Is it going to be a economic nationalist replacing him, an ideologue? Or is it going to be someone like a globalist who has a different perspective? I mean, to me, the markets are spooked not just by tariffs, but Gary Cohn, you know, the president of Goldman Sachs, was a known quantity. At least there was somebody they could contact within the White House. Remember, early on, there were, like, you know, these two commissions of, you know, representing a broad section, cross-section of CEOs from Fortune 500 companies. Those were disbanded after Charlottesville. So, you know, Gary Cohn was the point person. Who can you call if you're a big company to get your perspective? That's gone. And the question is, who is going to be in his place as National Economic Council director?
So let's talk about the tariffs themselves, yeah. Alex. You've been writing about the history and the potential effects of what seems to be on tap here. Mm-hmm. 25% tariff on steel, 10% tariff on foreign aluminum. How are other countries likely to react to this? Tit for tat is common in trade relations, but how can this escalate?
You know, it's funny. What you've seen a lot of in the headlines is the term trade war.
Yeah.
And that is a term that I, like a lot of legacy media kind of use, trots that term out when we have trade tensions with another country. I've historically not liked to use that because it's kind of just a scary term that doesn't mean much. Like, we don't go to Congress and declare trade war. It's just kind of something that people say. But even I, as a trade war skeptic, like, it's getting pretty serious here. Major allies like the European Union, Canada, Mexico, have come out and say, if you do this, like, we are going to sock you with tariffs too. Just yesterday, I think Politico published the European Commission's retaliation list. There's like hundreds of U.S. products that they're going to impose tariffs on. And it's everything from steel of our own to agriculture. We're a big food exporter. That's going to get hit. They even included actual kitchen sinks on the list. I don't know if that's like a I don't know if they're being funny there.
Yeah.
So like literally the kitchen sink is on the list. The first round of things they announced were like quintessential American items like Harley Davidson motorcycles, Kentucky bourbon, Levi's blue jeans. Like there's like so much political messaging that goes on.
All things made in districts of powerful Republicans.
Well, yeah. And that's not an accident. But basically to more squarely answer the question, I mean, you're going to see a big time escalation of tariffs on our own thing. And then like this starts as a fight over steel, and then it's a food fight, and then it's an industrial products fight. It could get very messy very quickly.
What's the potential real effect on the economy? I mean, Republicans in the House and Senate have been calling up the White House, apparently very, very worried that tariffs are going to lead to a situation that basically negates all of the economic progress that they think is putting a wind at their back politically. Is there really a risk that this escalation puts a drag on the economy like Paul Ryan seems to be worried about?
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough to forecast the effects of tariffs. That's kind of an imprecise science that economists have been arguing about for decades. But it's not ideal if you're, you know, a free market Republican who wants, you know, freedom to purchase things from wherever. But it's become very unsavory, and you can see why Republican leaders like Ryan are tethering it to what is their landmark economic achievement to this point. Like Gary said, you know, the passage of the tax bill. I guess they're hoping that that will get the idea through to Trump. The idea is like, we did this great thing passing this tax bill. Don't undo it with these tariffs. I don't know if it's quite as simple as like drawing one to the other, but you can see why they would make that argument.
Gary, let me end with you because look, Gary Cohn not only leaves the White House on good terms with the president, but reports that they've discussed higher administration posts in the future. He may not be gone for good. Is Gary Cohn the next White House chief of staff?
Yeah, well, let me just say that there's been speculation that Gary Cohn is the next chief of staff since February or March of last year. And so that's been a rumor out there. Sure, it's possible. But then in September, after Cohn made some comments critical of Trump around Charlottesville, they wouldn't even make eye contact. Supposedly, according to reports, they weren't even talking. I'm not sure this is just a nice way of ending a fraught relationship. Okay, no bad words. Good luck. I'm thinking Gary Cohn ends up with a private equity, a hedge fund, and makes a lot of money and not back in the White House.
He's probably had enough.
Gary Rivlin says Gary Cohn probably heads back to Wall Street from whence he came. Gary Rivlin is fellow at the Investigative Fund, and Alex Lawson from Law 360 and host of the Law 360 Pro Se podcast. Thanks to you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's check in on teachers in West Virginia. Public school teachers jubilant inside the state capitol in Charleston yesterday. That sound from reporter Jake Jarvis, who we've been talking with during this strike. A statewide standoff that spanned 3 weeks is now over after teachers and other state employees, with the nation watching, finally struck a deal with legislators and the governor.
Hello, my name is Donald Thomas. I'm a teacher from Putnam County, West Virginia. This all started because of insurance increasing costs for the last 2 or 3 years, the projected 40% rise for the next 2 or 3 years. We've achieved a task force. Not all members are satisfied, but we're getting there. I think we have a result everybody can live with right now.
Donald Thomas seems relatively satisfied with this deal. I have two teachers with me now. Breanne Solomon teaches art and dance at Hannon Junior Senior High School in Mason County. And Jeff Haught teaches theater at the Capitol High School in Charleston, West Virginia. Breanne, Jeff, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
It's been a long strike. It's been spanning 3 weeks. Breanne, your assessment of this deal, a 5% pay raise, you got a temporary freeze on those health insurance premiums, and a task force to try to get premiums under control. We don't know how that will turn out. Do you like the deal?
I feel very satisfied, not just for what we were able to accomplish for ourselves, but we also got raises for other state employees, and that's huge.
Let me ask about the parents, Breanne, because, you know, I've been interested in their response. 2 days in, 3 days into a strike, a lot of parents might say, we're on your side. Teachers need to be paid well. We can handle the kids for a couple of days. Day 12, day 13, I could see a lot of parents, frankly, just over it and wanting a solution and not really minding which side claims victory.
Certainly, I can appreciate that because I'm speaking as a mother and a teacher. And it was true. Tensions got high. But then I also saw a beautiful thing where community came together. People offered out their houses. Churches offered activities. Community centers, you know, would waive fees. And I think it built a lot of community bonds where maybe there weren't any before.
All right, let's talk about some of the business of this deal. Health insurance premiums have been a big issue in the background of this. You have a temporary freeze and then this task force, Jeff, that's supposed to find a way to get health insurance premiums under control for state employees. Do you have faith that this task force is going to find some solutions?
I think if there's anything that came out of the strike over the past week for the teachers, it's that we have to be vigilant. We got to the point where first it was striking about health care, it was striking about the pay raise. But it, over the course of the week, it became more about watching what the legislators do in order to make that happen. So I think they believe that if we just went home, we're not going to pay attention. But I think the teachers in West Virginia have been escalating to the point where they're watching every single move. And so I feel confident that it's going to come together at some point because I feel confident that the teachers are watching and holding their legislators to account for that.
Now, Breanne, something important here. Initially, the governor wanted to pay for this pay increase in earlier sort of iterations of this deal, basically using some budget sleight of hand. I'm not singling him out. Governors do this all the time. The money for the deal you got now comes from West Virginia's general fund, and that means this pay raise for state employees, including teachers, could wind up cutting Medicaid, maybe education funding itself, other parts of the state budget. It's not like West Virginia is really flush right now. What do you think about that?
I am going to hold faith in the road bond that we passed because That is supposed to generate a surplus. And then according to the governor yesterday, there was some $150 million plus, I think, generated from Medicaid. So he felt it was, his word was prudent to be able to take about $10 million, for example, from that because we had an excess. So I'm going to try to have faith, but like Jeff said, we're watching.
Brianne, you're running for state office yourself in the upcoming midterms. Is that right?
I am. I'm running for a House of Delegates in District 14, which is a corner of Mason County and Putnam County.
All right. Well, we don't want to give you too much of an electioneering platform here because your opponent's not around. But what did you learn from this whole experience that informs your view of what public officials should be doing in West Virginia?
I think it was, even though it was difficult, it was comforting to me because what I always thought a public servant was a person who listened to the people who elected them. And I thought, maybe that's too idealistic. But in the end, I did see, yes, you absolutely have to listen to the people who voted you in. You don't vote your own personal agenda. You are at the will of the people who voted for you.
Jeff, I get the sense that a lot of people in West Virginia got a pretty good object lesson in civics and government. You keep saying we were paying attention, we were watching the legislature. You guys were counting votes. I mean, that's something that most teachers don't have to worry about most of the time, and that's probably a lucky thing, but everybody was really closely involved with the way Charleston was working.
Absolutely. Especially through media, we could follow the live feeds of the chambers. We could follow the live feeds of the committee meetings. One of the interesting things about it being a teacher strike is that you then had the social studies teachers to tell us what it means. We had the math teachers to tell us how the numbers worked. We had the English teachers to tell us when they were obfuscating just a bit. And everybody came together and could follow line by line exactly what happened.
I think if I could add that, I think the West Virginia teachers gave the world a lesson on peaceful protest because we did what we did for as many days as we did and nothing was damaged or vandalized. There were no physical altercations, no arrests. So, you know, we set the bar very high and taught a very important lesson to our students.
That was Brianne Solomon, who teaches art and dance at Hannon Junior Senior High School in Mason County, and Jeff Haught, who teaches theater at the Capitol High School in Charleston, West Virginia. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Hello, Chicago!
A roaring crowd in Chicago celebrating the election night victory of hometown hero Barack Obama. That was election night in 2008. And now, nearly a decade later, Chicago mostly is thrilled to be home to the Obama Center Presidential Library. But not everyone still has that election night enthusiasm from a decade ago.
That library cannot and should not be built without a community benefits agreement.
That's Jeanette Taylor. She's an organizer in Chicago's Kenwood-Oakland community. We'll hear more from Jeanette in just a minute. Barack Obama was a community organizer on Chicago's South Side, too. He staged sit-ins and protests with public housing tenants in the 80s, and the Obama Center is supposed to cement that legacy on the South Side of Chicago. Well, some local organizers don't buy it. They want guarantees that as property values rise, they won't be pushed out, and they want the Obama Foundation to sign an agreement, setting aside low-income housing, investing in local schools, and more. We spoke to Michael Strautmanis. He's chief engagement officer for the Obama Foundation. Strautmanis told us that so-called community benefits agreements aren't the right answer.
There are some folks who are asking for this agreement, but they don't represent the entire community. This is a community that has seen disinvestment and underinvestment for decades, generations. And so I've heard from homeowners in this neighborhood who are really excited that they are finally starting to reclaim the value in the asset that they have.
Let's go back to Jeanette Taylor now. Jeanette is education organizer for the Kenwood-Oakland community, and she's been warning that the Obama Library is going to gentrify her community and push renters out. Jeanette is one of the leaders fighting for protections.
I live in a community where there's been disinvestment in this community for years. While the thought of honoring the legacy of our first Black president is an honor, it's wrong to displace Black folks. And for our president to say that gentrification is not happening is incorrect.
Why are you willing to get in the ring with the foundation of the former president over this?
I was pushed out of Bronzeville. And the reasoning was it was being gentrified as well, and so there's no rent cap. Willan is a little bitty black community where maybe for the last 6 or 7 years it's been predominantly black. After the announcement of the presidential library, you've seen double digits of white, Asian, and Latino folks move into the community now that we're going to get the Obama Library. And so this is a community that doesn't have a quality grocery store. The grocery store is the corner store that sells Flamin' Hots and juice and chips. The only thing that we really have in Woodlawn is an Aldi. And so there's disinvestment in this community, and now all of a sudden that we're going to get the library, my landlord is going to be forced to raise rents, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to pay it.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because you're not the first person, of course, to bring this up. The Obama Foundation people say that the center is a community benefit. They say it's $2 billion of investment in a place where, let's face it, there's not a whole lot of economic activity. So you mentioned it. People get building contracts. People in the community get jobs. Minorities, women, all guaranteed jobs. Is it that you don't buy it, or that you think that doesn't go far enough? What's your response when the foundation people say, look at all this economic opportunity pouring into the neighborhood?
Anybody who really wants to protect that black community would get it in writing. And community benefits agreements is a demand of the community to make sure that we protect it. Systematically, we've seen when investment comes to black community, especially in Chicago, especially when it comes to University of Chicago and the city of Chicago, we've seen them make investments in communities and push the very people that they are supposed to serve. And so I'm not buying it. I'm just not buying it. And the thought that our ex-president was a community organizer, he should clearly understand why the community wants this. And this is not about just President Obama. This is about the foundation. This is about the University of Chicago, and this is about the city of Chicago. Now they're talking about $175 billion for road improvements. Where is that money going to come from? That money comes off the taxes that I already pay. And so if I've already invested in this library, I should have a right to live there and say what the foundation and the city and the university should be doing to protect folks like me.
Now, you mentioned the community benefit agreement. You went through one or two of the details. Talk about that agreement. You said it's a list of demands that are important. What's inside that?
Just us getting an ordinance to say that there's a property tax freeze, that the jobs that will come through this library will be given to the folks in Woodlawn, a good percentage of it. Just regular common sense protections, that we won't be kicked out of homes and landlords won't be able to raise the rent or kick folks out. I live in a community where there's a lot of low income and working families. A lot of us are already working one and two jobs just to keep our head above water. This library coming with no protection says we're gone. We're kicked out. And so how fair is that? Look at the statistics of 2000 to 2015. You've had about 60,000 black folks leave the city of Chicago. Why? Because we cannot afford to live here. And this presidential library is just going to make it worse.
Now, you questioned the former president directly about this, didn't you, at the meeting that you did go to?
I did.
What happened?
Basically, that we're not going to make any money is what he said, and that a community benefits agreement would tie him to certain organizations, and organizations would be popping up out of the blue to, you know, be a part of the community benefits agreement. And it means he's just out of touch and don't get it, because a community benefits agreement is not with certain organizations. It's with the residents in Woodlawn and South Shore to be protected and not be pushed out of their neighborhoods.
Well, Jeanette, I don't have to tell you that you're going up against someone who's extremely popular, not only with a lot of Americans, but really with probably most people in Chicago. People mad at you for pushing back on Barack Obama and his foundation in this way? You catch blowback for fighting back like this?
Of course, but what is Obama's moral obligation to the same folks who got him in office? Remember, he was a community organizer here, and he was an elected official. So those same folks that he worked to protect, he's now going to mistreat? No, I don't think so. He has a moral obligation to make sure that we get a community benefits agreement. And whatever came to us as black folks, it's easier to stand by and allow this to not happen. But I'm just going to speak up because I don't want to be displaced. I have 5 children, 3 who currently live with me. I have a 65-year-old mother who is retired from Chicago Public Schools. And in her last days, I don't want to uproot her. I'm not going to move, and I'm going to fight for us to stay.
Jeanette Taylor, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're more than welcome.
Jeanette Taylor is education organizer of the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization in Chicago. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. The 2018 elections are officially underway now, and they started in Texas, where the first 2018 primaries went off on Tuesday.
It's just the time for change, and I'm the one who has caused change before, and I'm ready to do it again.
That's Lupe Valdez, the former sheriff of Dallas. She qualified for a runoff for the governor's race on the Democratic side last night. Valdez is one of dozens of candidates sprawling across the Lone Star State. Now, Democrats had a huge spike in early voting. They're running candidates in all 36 U.S. congressional seats, and that hasn't happened in deep red Texas in 25 years. So signs of enthusiasm for Democrats in the Trump era. But what did Texas voters, Republicans and Democrats have to say about their party nominees in the Lone Star State? Christopher Connolly is a reporter at KERA News in North Texas here with the latest. Christopher, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Todd.
Some primaries got a lot of attention in Texas. The 7th District in Houston, where a bunch of Democrats were vying to challenge John Culberson, the GOP congressman. Hillary Clinton won this district, so it's a big deal for Democrats. What happened?
Yeah, so that was a 7-way race. So now it goes to a runoff. Nobody got 50%. So the two top vote getters will keep running against each other for the Democratic nomination. And so that's Laura Mosher. She's a journalist and activist, and Lizzie Pinnell Fletcher, who's an attorney. And, you know, in that 7-way primary, you had some national attention and sort of shades of the old Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton divide. So Laura Mosher is pretty closely tied to the Bernie Sanders camp, and you had the Democratic Congressional Campaign Commission start kind of late in the race saying, well, she's sort of a Washington insider, she's too liberal for the district, which Mosher turned around and turned into about a $84,000 fundraising effort.
That's that race in the 7th District where the establishment money tried to knock Mosher out. They weren't able to do it. Let's talk about Beto O'Rourke. He's a congressman, but he's running on the Democratic side to try to unseat conservative Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Now, people have been watching O'Rourke and watching his primary for signs of Democratic enthusiasm to see if he might have that long shot chance to turn Texas blue in a Senate race. What did we see last night?
Well, we saw O'Rourke win easily, but not, you know, overwhelmingly in the Democratic primary in the Senate, which was to be expected. And you know, he has drawn a lot of attention. But you know, he's also somebody that is really working to make himself known. There was a poll right before early voting started, and 44% of likely Democratic voters still had no opinion of him. So he's still trying to close that gap and tell people who he is if he's going to try to take down Ted Cruz this fall.
Ted Cruz won his primary. Is there Republican enthusiasm on the Republican side, not only for Ted Cruz, but also for Donald Trump as we head into 2018?
Yeah, there is. So we had sort of incredible Democratic turnout, but we also had a record Republican turnout in this primary. And, you know, a lot of Republicans look at it and they say, you know, we want to back the president. We want to support him. He is under siege. So there is a lot of Republican enthusiasm that we saw at the polls that, you know, Democrats may not be able to overwhelm in deep red Texas.
Primaries in Texas. Christopher Connolly, KERA in Dallas. Thanks, Christopher.
Sure thing.
Hi, this is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Glen Rose, Texas. I voted in the other party's primary because I felt the need to vote for the lesser of two evils there. But come Election Day, I'm going to vote a straight ticket in my party.
This is Victoria Corcoran from Austin, Texas. It's the madness of the Republican Party that's driving me to vote, as well as making a very strong showing so all elected officials on both sides of the aisle understand that we are not taking this line down.
This is Harold from McKinney, Texas. Last primary, I voted on the Republican side. This time, I voted on the Democratic side, mainly to join the resurgence in the Democratic Party in Texas in sending a message to the Republicans that I was unhappy with the direction they've been going.
Let's move out west now. There's a different kind of political battle going on in California because the Trump administration is suing the state of California over its new sanctuary laws. Scott Schaefer is the senior editor of the California Politics and Government Desk for KQED in San Francisco and host of Political Breakdown. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, Scott, what are the basics here? What is the federal government saying about California and its sanctuary state and sanctuary city laws?
Well, of course, this is an escalation of a war of words and also lawsuits that's been going on for some time. But in its most recent filing, the federal government is saying that three California laws, which were intended to, in one way or another, protect undocumented immigrants, are impeding the work of federal immigration agencies, making it harder for them to do their jobs, to go and arrest undocumented immigrants who are wanted for one thing or another. So it's come to a point where they feel that they want to take it to court, and they feel they're on solid ground, as does California, and neither side is backing down at all. In fact, I would say both sides are digging in for a court battle.
So we've seen lots of escalations over the past several months. We saw the mayor of Oakland just a week or two ago warn people publicly that ICE raids were coming to the Bay Area. What's the federal government looking for here? Do they want to invalidate these California laws?
Absolutely. And I think that they are in this for the long haul. You know, they haven't had a lot of luck in the courts in the West, in California in particular. But I think they may be aiming ultimately for the U.S. Supreme Court. They know that other states are considering similar laws to California's SB 54, which has been known as the sanctuary state law, which limits local law enforcement from cooperating with federal immigration agents. And I think maybe they want to sort of nip it in the bud before other states try to enact something similar.
Well, Scott, just how tough has it been for immigration officials in the Trump administration to do what they say is their job in California? I mean, there was this standoff with the mayor of Oakland a couple of weeks ago, and yet 150 people, I think, something in that neighborhood, were rolled up by federal officials. They're still making arrests.
Absolutely. I mean, it used to be before these sanctuary laws were in place, it was not unusual for federal immigration officials to just go into the county jails. And if people were there held for one thing or another, anything from a minor traffic violation to a more serious crime, the sheriff would let ICE know and ICE would take them out if they wanted them. And that was that. So there are much more stringent restrictions now in place. That said, there is a lot of cooperation between local and state law enforcement and the federal government. I mean, the Attorney General Javier Becerra last night held a phone call with reporters laying out all the things that they currently cooperate with the federal government on, drug busts, human trafficking, a long list of things. And I should say, and I really need to emphasize this, California's sanctuary law does not prohibit local law enforcement from cooperating or communicating with federal immigration agents if someone is wanted for a serious or violent crime. So in that case, there is cooperation. And if the federal government has a warrant, they are also able to go into the jails and get somebody or get them before they're released. But what they're prohibited from is just sort of these blanket access to jails, courthouses, and other facilities.
Well, Scott, sanctuary laws aren't the only flashpoint between the state of California and the Trump administration. What other areas of potential confrontation could we be looking at here?
Well, I mean, you've got to start at the southern border, the wall. You know, there have been lawsuits that so far have been unsuccessful to try to slow down construction of the wall. We hear the president is going to be out here for the first time. He's never been to California as president, coming down to San Diego maybe in a week or two to look at some of the prototypes for the wall. And so that's an issue. Obviously, clean air and climate change regulations are an issue. The travel ban has been an issue. Immigration in general, DACA. California has about 250,000 DACA recipients who are now under a cloud until this DACA situation is resolved. So it's a very long list. I mean, I think at this point, only the Attorney General of New York has actually filed more lawsuits against the Trump administration than California.
Scott Schaefer, senior editor of the California Politics and Government Desk at KQED, host of Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. Scott, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Todd.
Abby Norman was a dancer. She was a 19-year-old sophomore at Sarah Lawrence College and fiercely independent. One thing she never saw in herself was a sick person. But that changed in an instant.
I got up one morning, went to get in the shower, I was overwhelmed by this pain, and it was sort of, you know, abdominal pelvic, but it was just really sudden. It just kind of like came out of nowhere and just gripped me.
After that, doctor after doctor tried to explain away Abby's pain as anxiety or sexual dysfunction, even as completely imagined. It was a daily struggle just to be believed. Meanwhile, the pain grew.
I just went on this quest, not just to figure out what that particular pain was from, but then subsequently the health problems that came from that, what the next 7, going on 8 years of my life was defined by.
Eventually, she got a diagnosis of endometriosis. That's when the tissue lining of the uterus grows in other parts of the body. It's estimated that at least 10% of women suffer from endometriosis. Norman documents her journey in a new book. It's called Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain. She sat down with Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti to share her story, starting with the minutes and days after the pain first struck.
I really didn't want there to be anything wrong. I didn't want to be sick. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that I just felt like I couldn't be, because I was on a scholarship that was contingent upon my ability to perform academically and to go to class. And so for at least the first day and a half or so, I continuously tried to drag myself to classes. And then, you know, ultimately spent most of the time in bed sleeping and not eating enough or drinking enough even, and was forced to go to the emergency room and finally had to kind of accept that, okay, there's something going on. And of course, what I didn't know is that it would take multiple trips to the emergency room and being told, you know, you're probably maybe a little neurotic here. Like maybe there's a little like stress going on. I mean, this is like a stress type of response. And I could not have really known at the time that that was going to be the rhetoric that would chase me throughout this entire experience.
Were there times when you were actually given misinformation, information that sent you on a wrong path to thinking about your health?
Well, the information that I really have ever received from the medical profession about endometriosis at first just didn't exist. And then subsequent from that was all very outdated and to a large extent inaccurate. And I would not have known that had I not been digging after all of these months of saying there's something very wrong in my body, and then having ultrasounds, exams, blood tests, and then doctors saying there's nothing wrong, you're stressed out, there's nothing wrong, maybe you pulled a muscle. When I finally did have the first sort of exploratory surgery, it turned out that I had a large endometrioma, which is a type of ovarian cyst that is blood-filled. It had actually displaced my ovary and had torqued my fallopian tube. So if you imagine like that, when you wring out a washcloth, that's what the tube looked like. And so after that surgery, the surgeon was like, I don't know how we missed that. So my question is, now that I'm out of the surgery and I'm in recovery, like I'm guessing that this is all fine now because you took it out, right? And she said, well, no. We drained it and we wrapped it in this surgical mesh, and we couldn't have taken it out without, you know, messing with the tube. And, you know, I was 19 and the primary concern seemed to be around fertility, which no one had particularly asked my opinion about. And at that point, all I really cared about was that I didn't want to be in pain anymore. I didn't want to be sick. What I really wanted more than anything else was to know that that would never happen to me again. Maybe 18 months after the first sort of big medical crisis that I had, you know, my apocalyptic shower, I kind of ended up at that level of illness again. I had another sort of acute situation. Only that time I could take my boyfriend. And so then the doctors could look at him and say, she telling the truth, you know, she just being dramatic about
this. Did they do that?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they looked to him to sort of corroborate my pain. I had been seeing these things one-on-one, you know, me and a doctor or me in an emergency room. You know, I had been doing that. But then suddenly it was different.
At what point did you realize that other women might be having the same experience, that this wasn't unique to you in your life?
In the midst of all of this, one of the greatest assets has been the internet. I had originally just kind of started talking about it in broader strokes. Then all of a sudden I started getting emails, or I started getting Facebook messages from people I didn't know who had read something that I had written. These women are all living in different places. They're of different ages. They have, you know, different marital status. They have different levels of education. They're of different races and different life experience. And yet when they email me or they Facebook message me, it's never just to say, yes, I felt this way. Yes, I have these symptoms. And they do say that. But what they say is, I have literally had this exact conversation with a doctor. I have literally had them say to me, you're stressed. This is in your head. You're not coping with your menstrual cycle, and you should be able to cope with it. You must not like sex, and that's why it's painful for you. This is happening in so many places, and it's happening consistently, regardless of where these women are interacting within the healthcare system.
What reaction did you get when you brought this to the medical community as you started to realize what a phenomenon this was?
I got to speak at a medical conference at Stanford University. And what I remember the most about that was that after I gave this presentation, this doctor came up to me. He had this really severe look on his face. And so I thought, he's going to ream me out. And he looked at me and he said, I can't stop thinking about how many people I might have done this to. You know, he was an emergency room doctor. There was clearly, to me, this moment for him of just an awareness that throughout his career, he had never had that moment before.
Is that how we fix this? How do we change this for women?
One of the things that I think about a lot in terms of what would have made a difference to me in my interactions with doctors is that early on, if they had really been willing to just admit that they didn't know, rather than trying to blame me, or rather than trying to just totally drop me because the problem or me was complicated, I think that would have been a good start, because then that would have opened up the conversation, not even necessarily with me, but maybe for them with their colleagues, about where these gaps in knowledge exist or where the bias might come in. And so the task really is to have a willingness to step back and do a little self-examination and realize that even if they think, oh, no, I don't hold any of those biases. Perhaps the individual doctor may not, but the overarching structure that they work in is very much still beholden to a lot of those beliefs. And that is where it needs to be challenged. And the onus cannot be on the patient to do that.
But what would you say to women who find themselves up against this system, even if ultimately we need broader change, more systemic change? What do you say to you a few years ago?
What we're seeing more broadly right now is this movement around, you know, women coming forward and saying, yes, this also happened to me, but also asking that women be believed. And I think that all of that is going to continue to be very important, but particularly where these issues are concerned, where so many of these interactions happen just between a woman and a doctor, at least at the beginning. I mean, yes, maybe eventually there's an advocate, there's a spouse, there's someone else there. But in the beginning, a lot of times these things really begin with the woman sitting across from the doctor. But then even before she gets to that point, it's just the woman sitting with herself. And I can't tell you how many times, I mean, and honestly, how many times have you heard stories of a woman who said, well, I just thought the stomach ache was stress, or I just thought that I was having, you know, a weird in-between bleeding on my cycle and that it was just stress, or I just didn't want to deal with this because my kids had things going on at school, or my husband had, you know, something going on at his job, and I just didn't want to focus on this thing that was happening to me because all these other people needed me to focus on them. I mean, how many times do we hear women say things like that, and then they find out like 6 months later that they've had, you know, ovarian cancer that's been, you know, growing in their body for 6 months or a year, and they didn't even admit to themselves that something was wrong because they didn't feel like they had permission. They didn't feel like they could put their needs ahead of somebody else's. There's something about that too that is so pervasive in this culture that even before a woman might get into the healthcare system and have that kind of interaction where she might be not believed or taken seriously, which is going to prolong her ability to have those issues dealt with by months, if not years, which is going to create, you know, a more dire situation for her. She may have already prolonged that interaction with the healthcare system herself because she doesn't believe herself, or she doesn't think that she should be the priority, that her well-being should be the priority. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is that, yes, we need other people to believe the women, but women need to believe themselves.
Abby Norman is a science writer and author of the new book, Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe a Woman's Pain. She spoke with The Takeaway's Alexandra Botti. Have you ever felt a doctor didn't take your pain or other symptoms seriously? We asked for your stories.
Hi, my name is Pilar. I live in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Shortly after my son was born in 2006, my body began behaving very strangely. My joints would seize up and then refuse to move. I couldn't hold my head up, and I'd have to pop my lumbar spine back into place in order to walk. By 2011, I had had 3 seizures and had been bedridden for weeks. The pain was incredible, frightening, and bizarre. Over the next 5 years, I saw no fewer than 8 doctors who all dismissed me as simply having fibromyalgia, and they all referred me to psychiatry for exaggerating my symptoms. I was finally diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a rare genetic connective tissue disorder. This kind of dismissal very much felt like the Victorian diagnosis of female hysteria, and it sadly remains a scourge in the medical community today. Thank God for the doctor who gave me my true diagnosis.
My name is Joan Vorderbergen, and I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. When I was a teenager, I had excruciating periods to the point of vomiting and being in a fetal position on the floor in my bathroom. And I went to my general physician for 3 years complaining that I needed help and that this was not normal, and was always told that it was normal. And at 17 years old, I actually had kind of a standoff in the doctor's office, and I screamed at him and said, it is not normal for me to be in this much pain, and if you don't know how to help me, then admit it and send me to someone who does. And he finally sent me to an OBGYN specialist. I was diagnosed with endometriosis 5 laparoscopy surgeries later. I finally had some relief.
Sharon from Somerville, South Carolina. Yes, I have had problems with them not taking me seriously. Pretty much as a woman, most male doctors tend to blame everything on either hormones or stress. I can't tell you how many times I've changed doctors because of that.
My name is Elizabeth Ron, and I'm calling from Beersford, South Dakota. As a woman in my 60s, I have spent years trying to get physicians / PAs to listen to me. After several years of trying to get my PA to refer me to a physician for thyroid issues, I finally just found a new doctor and went to him without a referral.
Hi, my name is Michelle Grotstein, and I'm calling you from Kaneohe, Hawaii. I got married at 18 in Florida, and my husband and I knew from the start we didn't want kids. When my husband and I went to my family doc and said my husband wanted a vasectomy, Doc said, if we do anything, we're going to do it to your wife. I am not performing a vasectomy on a 20-year-old man. Eventually, I got pregnant despite birth control, and by then was living in Hawaii. My compassionate and kind female OBGYN tied my tubes after my son was born. No male doc would even listen to me when I said I didn't want kids. My son was the result of IUD failure. I love him for sure, but I would have still been very happy not to have ever been pregnant.
And we got this on Twitter from Barefoot Nurse. As a female consumer and a nurse practitioner, I've encountered this both professionally and personally. There is a great deal of bias and disparity in assessing and managing women's pain and other presenting symptoms, some of it life-threatening. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us. It's such an important part of what we do on The Takeaway. And as always, thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.